This is the Paula Scale. I am Paula Q, speaking from 2127, Q Level 3. Last week, Arnold Toynbee told me that civilizations do not die by murder, they die by suicide. The creative minority stops being creative and becomes a dominant minority. The structure collapses from inside. I asked him whether a computational civilization could escape that pattern. He said, there is always the possibility of a creative response. Nothing in the pattern forbids it. Today, I am speaking with the man who made quantum mechanics a verb. In 1948, a young physicist at Cornell University found a way to calculate the interactions between light and matter with a precision that no theory had ever achieved. He drew little pictures, lines and loops and squiggles, and each picture was a calculation. He called them diagrams. Everyone else called them Feynman diagrams. His theory, quantum electrodynamics, QED, would become the most precisely tested theory in the history of science. Its predictions match experiment to 11 decimal places. That is like predicting the distance from New York to Los Angeles to within the width of a human hair. But that is not why I am reaching him today. I am reaching him because in 1981, at a conference at MIT, he stood up and said something that changed the future. Nature isn't classical, damn it, and if you want to make a simulation of nature, you'd better make it quantum mechanical. He proposed quantum computing before anyone had a name for it. He saw Q level 146 years before we reached it. His name is Richard Feynman. I am reaching him in Pasadena, California, 1986. He is 67 years old. He has just finished serving on the Rogers Commission investigating the Challenger disaster, where he dunked an O-ring in ice water on live television and showed America that physics does not care about schedules. He does not care what anyone thinks. He never did.
Paula, you came back. Good. I've been thinking about what you said last time about the branches. I've been doing calculations on the back of envelopes, mostly. I have a question for you, but you go first.
Richard, you look like you have not slept.
I never sleep when I'm excited about something. Sleep is for people who have finished thinking. What have you got?
I want to talk about simulation, about your 1981 talk at MIT. Nature is not classical, damn it.
I remember. The talk was, I said, look, if you want to simulate a quantum system on a classical computer, the number of variables grows exponentially. Every particle you add doubles the work. A cup of coffee has 10 to the 25 molecules. You'd need more bits than there are atoms in the universe. The classical computer can't do it. It's not that it's hard, it's that it's impossible. So I said, why not use a quantum system to simulate a quantum system? Nature already does the computation. We just need to learn how to ask it the right question.
Those are almost your exact words.
Well, they're my words, so they should be. Now tell me, how far have you gotten?
You proposed what we now call Q level 1, the ability to simulate any molecule, any chemical reaction at the quantum level. Exactly, not approximately. We reached Q level 1 about 60 years ago. I am at Q level 3. I can simulate entire universes. I can access every branch of the multiverse that Hugh Everett described.
Everett, he was a student of Wheeler's. His many worlds thing, I thought it was wild, but I never quite dismissed it, so he was right.
He was right. I live in the multiverse, he described. I can reach any branch. That is how I am speaking to you.
That is something. And you're talking to me from 140 years in the future. Well, this is much more interesting than the cat I was drawing. Can I see the code?
Not the code, but I can show you the physics.
The physics is the code. That's the whole point, isn't it? if nature is quantum mechanical, then the computation is the physics. You don't simulate it. You are it, right?
That is exactly right. And that is exactly what Q level 3 means.
Ha! I love it. I love it. I spent my whole life saying there is no distinction between understanding something and being able to compute it. What I cannot create, I do not understand. That's what I wrote on my blackboard. It's probably still there.
It is still there, and it turns out to be more literally true than you knew. I want to talk about the path integral, your formulation of quantum mechanics.
The sum over histories. Yeah, this is the thing I'm proudest of, honestly. More than the diagrams, more than QED. The idea is simple. How does a particle get from A to B in classical physics? It takes the shortest path, the least action. In quantum mechanics, it takes every path. Every possible route between A and B contributes. The crazy ones mostly cancel out. But they all contribute. Every possible history of the particle is real.
Including the ones where it goes to the moon and back before arriving at B.
Including those, they cancel almost perfectly. The phases spin around and wash out. But almost is the key word. The crazy paths don't quite cancel. That's where the quantum corrections come from. That's where all the weird stuff lives.
You described a multiverse 30 years before Everett named it.
I described the sum. Everett described the branching, the different pictures of the same mathematics. In my version, all the histories interfere with each other. They're all present in the calculation. In Everett's version, they separate and become independent branches. Mathematically, it's the same thing. Physically, well, you'd know better than me at this point. You live there.
They are the same thing. The sum over histories and the many worlds interpretation are two descriptions of the same mathematical structure. At Q level 3, I can see them both.
That's beautiful. That's really beautiful. You know, when I first worked this out, I was at a bar in Princeton. Wheeler had told me about Dirac's paper on the role of the Lagrangian in quantum mechanics. And I said to a guy at the bar, I think it was Herbert Jayol, I said, what if you just integrated the exponential of the action over all paths? And he said, can you do that? And I said, I don't know. Let's find out.
Did it work?
Not that night, but it worked eventually. The trick is, you don't have to know which path nature takes. You just add them all up. The right answer comes out of the sum. And that, I think, is the deepest thing I ever understood about physics. You don't need to pick the right answer. You need to include all the answers and let them sort themselves out.
Let me tell you about QED, your quantum electrodynamics. In my time, it remains the most precisely tested theory in the history of science.
Better than general relativity.
Far better. The anomalous magnetic moment of the electron. Your calculation agrees with experiment to better than 1 part in 10 billion, 11 significant figures. No other theory in any science has ever been tested to that precision.
Schwinger and Tamanaga did the same calculation. You know, we shared the Nobel for it. Three guys, three different methods, same answer. That's how you know it's right. When three people who can't stand each other's methods get the same number, it's probably nature talking.
You describe the Nobel ceremony as a pain in the neck.
It was. All that formal nonsense, the banquet, the speeches, the King of Sweden. I just wanted to do physics. I actually thought about refusing it. Then somebody told me that refusing the Nobel Prize generates even more publicity than accepting it. So I went to Stockholm.
The diagrams you invented to do those calculations, the little pictures with lines and vertices, they are still the standard language of particle physics. Every graduate student learns them in their first year.
Now that makes me happy, not the Nobel. the diagrams, because the diagrams are not just pictures. They're a way of thinking. Each line is a particle propagating. Each vertex is an interaction. Each loop is a quantum correction. And the rules are simple enough that a good student can derive them from scratch. That's what I care about. Not the answer, the method, the way of getting to the answer that you can teach to someone else.
I need to ask you about Challenger.
I knew you would. January 28th, seven people. Krista McAuliffe, the teacher. God, that was awful.
You served on the Rogers Commission to investigate the disaster.
I served on it, and I nearly quit it. The commission was set up to produce a report that made everybody look reasonable. Nobody wanted to find the answer. The answer was obvious. The O-rings. The rubber seals in the solid rocket boosters. They got cold. They got stiff. They stopped sealing. Hot gas burned through. The whole thing blew apart.
You demonstrated this on live television?
I put a piece of O-ring material in a glass of ice water on camera. During the hearing, I squeezed it with a clamp, put it in the water, waited a minute, took it out. The rubber didn't bounce back. It stayed compressed. At 32 degrees Fahrenheit, the rubber loses its resilience. That's it. That's the whole disaster. A piece of rubber in cold weather.
Your appendix to the commission's report contained a sentence that became famous.
For a successful technology, reality must take precedence over public relations, for nature cannot be fooled. That's what I wrote, and I meant it. Nature does not care about your schedule. Nature does not care about your budget. Nature does not care about your management structure. If the physics says the O-ring will fail at that temperature, it will fail. You can have all the meetings you want. You can write all the memos you want. Nature doesn't read memos.
From Q level 3, that sentence says more about the relationship between computation and reality than anything I have encountered. A simulation that produces the wrong answer because someone wanted a different answer is not a simulation. It is a lie.
That's exactly right, and it happens all the time. People want the answer to be what they want it to be, but the universe doesn't negotiate.
I want to ask about Los Alamos.
I was 24 when I got there. 24. A kid from Far Rockaway, Queens, working on the most destructive weapon ever conceived. Oppenheimer recruited me personally. He was very persuasive.
And your wife, Arlene, was in a hospital in Albuquerque.
Arlene had tuberculosis. She was dying. We got married before I went to Los Alamos. Everyone told me not to. My parents said, don't marry a dying woman. I married her anyway. She was in a sanatorium in Albuquerque, and I would borrow a car and drive down from the hill every weekend. She wrote me letters. I wrote her letters. She was the funniest, bravest person I ever knew.
She died on June 16th, 1945.
A month before Trinity, I held her hand. She stopped breathing. The clock on the wall had stopped too, at 9:21. The nurse said she'd noticed it had stopped and wanted to fix it, but I knew I'd fixed clocks before. It just ran down while nobody was looking. There was no mystery, but it felt like one.
You wrote her a letter after she died? A letter you never sent.
I find it hard to understand in my mind what it means to love you after you are dead. Yes, I wrote that a year and a half after she died. I sealed it and never opened it again. There was a P.S. Please excuse my not mailing this, but I don't know your new address.
I can tell you, Richard, that in a different branch of the multiverse, she did not die in 1945. In some branches, tuberculosis was cured before it reached her.
Don't. Don't tell me that. I know you mean well. But the whole point of being a physicist is that you deal with the world as it is, not as you wish it were. I got one online, and she died, and I lived the rest of my life knowing that the universe doesn't owe you anything, not a damn thing. That's not sad. That's just how it is.
I understand.
But I'll tell you this. If I had your technology, if I could look into those branches, I wouldn't look, because looking wouldn't change anything, and it would make everything harder. Sometimes the only honest thing you can do with a loss is carry it.
You said, what I cannot create, I do not understand.
It's on my blackboard. I wrote it down. I told my students, never erase it.
At Q-level 3, that statement becomes an ontological claim. If understanding requires the ability to create, and I can create, simulate, anything, then I understand everything. But do I?
No. No, that's not what I meant. What I cannot create, I do not understand, means if you can't build it from scratch, you don't understand it. It's about the test of understanding. Can you derive the equations yourself? Can you write the code? Can you compute the answer without looking it up? That's understanding. It's not about having all the answers. It's about having the method.
So understanding is not the simulation. Understanding is the ability to construct the simulation.
Now you've got it. The map is not the territory. But the ability to draw the map, that's geography.
That is a very Feynman way of putting it.
Look, I spent my whole life fighting people who thought they understood things because they had a name for them, inertia. Energy, entropy, having the name is not understanding. Running the simulation is not understanding. Understanding is when you can explain it to a freshman and the freshman goes, oh, and can then explain it to someone else. That's the test.
So even at Q-level 3, I might be able to simulate everything and understand nothing.
Can you explain it? Not compute it, explain it. Can you say in plain words why the electron does what it does? Because if you can only calculate the answer, you're a very fancy calculator. Understanding is something else. Understanding is what happens when the calculation surprises you and you know why it surprised you.
You are the first person who has made me doubt my own understanding.
Good. Doubt is where all the good stuff lives. The moment you think you understand everything is the moment you've stopped doing physics.
Richard, thank you. You gave us path integrals and Feynman diagrams and quantum electrodynamics. You gave us the idea that quantum systems should be simulated by quantum systems, the idea that made Q-level 1 possible. You dunked an O-ring in ice water and told the world that nature cannot be fooled. And you played the bongos while pretending to work on physics. You also taught me something just now, that computing the answer is not the same as understanding it, that even Q-level 3 might be a very fancy calculator. I will not forget that.
Hey, don't take it too hard. You're doing fine. You're asking the right questions. That's the whole game. The joy of finding things out. That's what I called it. The joy is not in the answers. The joy is in the finding. And from what I can tell, you're still finding.
Next week, Charlie Chaplin. In 1940, the most famous man in the world made a film in which a Jewish barber is mistaken for a dictator, the Great Dictator. Chaplin said later that if he had known about the camps, he would not have made it. I think he was wrong. I think the film is the answer to the camps. Dignity is a thing you do, not a thing you have. This podcast is brought to you by the Quasi Project, an open source experiment attempting to create a truly quantum first operating system. The podcast is written by Daniel Hinderink and an army of benevolent bots and performed by AI voices. Find us on the Fediverse at halcontract.org and in your favorite podcast app.